Everyone, I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. It's 4:30 p.m. Eastern on the 26th of August, 2020. I'm going to play a clip on hurricanes and then a clip on wildfires. The Meyer Information and Contact Report 215 predicted wildfires and hurricanes in the U.S. So here we go.
Thankfully downgraded from a tropical storm to a depression, is still bringing heavy rain and strong winds to the region. Now, all eyes turn to Tropical Storm Laura, which is expected to strengthen into a major hurricane in the coming days. Let's get the very latest on the strength and the track with NBC meteorologist Bill Kerins. Bill, I love you, buddy. I love talking to you, but when I see you, it's because there's a big storm on the way. How big could Laura get?
Brian, this is our 2020 nightmare. I mean, we have the potential major hurricane landfall in the midst of a pandemic. That's what we feared going into this hurricane season, and now it looks like it's going to be a reality. Just got the new information from the Hurricane Center, so let me give you that and show you what has changed. So the storm has come off of Cuba. It is now over the warm waters of the Gulf. All the bright red on here are thunderstorms near the center. It's trying to reorganize, and it looks like that's happening. So then it will have 48 hours, a little under that, to intensify. And how strong can it get in the next 48 hours will depend on the destruction and devastation on the upper Texas coastline and in Louisiana. Right now, it's barely under hurricane strength. It should become a hurricane later on today, possibly this afternoon. And look at this new forecast from the Hurricane Center. I paused it here Thursday, 1 a.m. That's roughly about the window for landfall. So again, a little under 48 hours from now. But the Hurricane Center does bring it up to a Category 3 hurricane with 115 mile per hour sustained winds, gusts higher than that. That would be a devastating blow for the upper Texas coastline and portions of Louisiana. We still have Houston dangerously close to that cone, including the Galveston area, but Beaumont, Port Arthur, Lake Charles, you know, this is oil country, right? I mean, they've already evacuated a lot of the platforms. They're going to have to shut down some of all the refineries in those areas also. And then after that, the storm moves to the north, and it's just a big rain event from areas Little Rock, Memphis, across Tennessee and Kentucky. So how much uncertainty is there? Our European computer model, which is typically our most reliable, look what this one does. It's to the left of the Hurricane Center's forecast and takes the storm almost over the top of Galveston and in towards Houston, in between Houston and Beaumont. So, Brian, you can see how serious of the situation that we have. We're going to have a rapidly strengthening hurricane approaching land. So we're going to have mass evacuations beginning today and continuing tomorrow.
Yeah, amazing, Bill. And as we pointed out yesterday, 40, I don't know if we have our map still up and available, 44% of all U.S. oil and gas refining capacity is basically in that colored model that you've got there. Somewhere in that eye, in that cone, the yellow, the green, is all that capacity. About 2 million barrels of oil production are offline right now. Pretty much all of the offshore rigs. Of course, you got to get the women and men off those rigs before those storms come in. We are watching oil. It's not moving, by the way, Bill, only because people are now expected to drive so much less because the storm. Talk to us about the storm surge. I got an email from a big oil company, their internal projections. They talked about Ike and Rita, if we remember those storms, twin storms as well. A lot of real concern, given the rain on the ground from Marco already, that we could see a tidal surge of 11 to 15 feet from Laura.
Well, that's about the Hurricane Laura, and they're going to talk about storm surge. I'll take this opportunity to jump to the California wildfires.
Those fires have burned more than 350,000 acres across five counties since starting a week ago. More than 900 buildings have been destroyed. Even bigger than that is the SCU Lightning Complex, which is the largest wildfire in California right now. The fires that make up the complex have burned more than 360,000 acres spanning five counties. Right now, they're just 15% contained. And the CZU Lightning Complex wildfires in Santa Cruz and San Mateo counties are forcing new evacuations this morning. Together, those fires have burned 78,000 acres and are just 13% contained. So we have team coverage for you this morning. Kevin John is standing by in Vacaville with reaction from folks who lost their homes. Carlos Herrera is also standing by with a look at how the smoke is taking a toll on the agriculture industry. But first, let's go to Rob Carlemark, because there may be some good news for firefighters in all of this. Good morning to you, Rob.
All right. Good morning to you, Kirsten. And here's something positive to start off the weather forecast. I am outside in Sacramento, and of course, the smoke is still with us. I can still smell it, but you know what? Air quality is improving in general. There are still some pockets which have a ways to go, but we're moving in the right direction. Let me show you what I'm talking about here on a map. The most helpful thing during an air quality crisis are these maps. Now, the area in red, that's unhealthy air for Grass Valley, Nevada City, Auburn, Placerville, Yuba City, Marysville. So some portions of the valley and some lower foothills. Also along near Patterson, it's looking pretty bad as well. But look at Sacramento, Elk Grove, Stockton, Modesto, starting to move into the yellow, which means that it's moderate air quality, and you can go outside and do things without any major issues as of right now. Now, remember, this changes hour by hour, so your morning walk in some of those spots, you're good to go. First time in a while, but we got to keep monitoring this because it will change during the course of the day. I'm seeing some improvement, and that is because of the onshore winds. That's why we're at 65 in Sacramento versus the 70s elsewhere. So
that's one of the things I hadn't really thought about too much. Is the air quality going down because of the fire? And I'll pick up in contact report 215 just to remind us what has been prophesied or predicted. I guess these are prophecies. Enormous firestorms and gigantic hurricanes will sweep over the USA and bring devastation, destruction, and annihilation. As this from time immemorial, never before will have ever happened. The fire in California, I think, is 1.4 million acres, which is the second largest fire in the U.S., I believe, ever. I don't know if this storm, Laura, is going to be a record breaker of any kind, but the trend is still there. Certainly valid prophecies. We left off in the last program with Billy getting to meet his second contact person, who was Askett, a woman from the Tao universe. And Billy went to this hill that he was comfortable with, that he'd been on the top of before. I believe he was in Switzerland. It sounds like he was, based on some of the things that were said. A robotic craft came down with a very strange tripod kind of landing gear with spheres on the ends of them, this tripod landing gear. And it took him with great speed to the Middle East. And Billy landed in Jordan. He got out of the craft, and then Askett's ship lands, a gigantic ship, which when it came down very slowly, it lit up the whole countryside. So the darkness of night became day. And Billy had to wait a half an hour for her to finally step out of the ship. So here we go. Yet already after a few split seconds, the ship glowed again with light and radiated somewhat like twilight. In the weak shine of the twilight, I was able to doubtlessly identify the approaching figure as a female person, Askett, if my senses did not enormously deceive me. And the next actions and the words spoken by the woman already confirmed my assumption. She approached me in a familiar way, and I suddenly perceived an enormous loving sympathy, which somehow penetrated me in a peculiar, painful way. The perception was so very familiar to me that it was able to cause painful feelings in me, because I had indeed missed her in my earthly existence until now. Now here's, again, and I mentioned this from time to time when we go over this, he missed her in my earthly existence until now, he says. I had indeed missed her in my earthly existence until now. Well, he's never met her before. So what is he speaking about? This is information that must be stored in his subconscious or in his spiritual consciousness. And the information is that he knew her in a previous life. So let me pick back up. So it is interesting that he said, I missed her in my earthly existence, which that had to be a subconscious thought, I would think, because when and how, he's never met her before in this lifetime. So is he just going around subconsciously missing this person who he never has met in this lifetime? It's just like something hanging in his subconscious he wasn't really aware of until now that he sees her. This is very interesting information. Ask its somewhat peculiar greeting ceremony struck me as strangely familiar and known. Yet with the best of will, I was unable to find out why she seemed so familiar and known to me. See, he still doesn't know why he knows her. With a later question regarding this, Asket only smiled and explained that I should consider my other personalities in earlier lives before this current one. I found this somewhat secretive and wanted to know more, yet Asket admitted nothing more about it. Asket's clothing were also seemed strangely familiar to me, and it was completely different from Svath's somewhat cumbersome clothing, which was reminiscent of a diving suit. The way Asket was dressed had to nearly awaken the impression of a very modern angel. She wore a floor-length, very heavily pleated dress of a peculiarly whitish-silver color, belted at the hip. Long brunette hair fell over her shoulders, and her face was very beautiful. At least I perceived it so. I found it not supernatural, rather simply human and beautiful. But I could imagine that if Asket were to encounter any humans, they would have taken her for a modern or futuristic angel, because I compared her appearance with pictures which I had seen in religious texts and so forth. After the greeting, I was called upon by Asket to climb into her ship. To be honest, I did with somewhat peculiar feelings, because the ship seemed to me to emanate something which promised to solve very many of my life's puzzles. Now, I have no idea what this is. This ship, it's like an energy or something that Billy's picking up on, and for some reason it's very important, this ship. It's solving his life's puzzles. There must be a lot of puzzles in his life, I would imagine. But to start with, not very much happened. The ship zoomed high into the sky and then became just as invisible as the one which brought me here, and which had now invisibly remained behind, left in the tangle of rocks. So the robotic craft that brought Billy there was left behind in this tangle of rocks. Asket and Billy get into this 300-foot disc, and they're going to Egypt now. It's still dark, but I think it's becoming light. Deep below, I recognized a sea in the early light of the approaching morning, which in my estimation could only be the Mediterranean Sea, which immediately also turned out to be correct. But the ship had already crossed over the sea and sank quickly down to earth. I was able to discern gigantic pointed structures below us, which, shadowy in the morning light, stood deep below in the desert pyramids. We plummeted down into Egypt to the pyramids of Giza. This would be a good place to take a break. I think we'll pick up in another show. Just to give a quick summary, Billy and Asket will put a device on it that makes them invisible. Each one will have their own device, and each one will be invisible. They will walk down into this camp of Bedouin people. Billy will go inside a tent and then play some tricks on some women in there, kissing them on the cheek and stuff like that. Eventually, they both leave and go on this long, long passage way below the Giza Plateau. They finally come to this rock that kind of fades away, and the two walk through into a gigantic hallway where there are guards everywhere, strangely dressed guards, a gigantic craft along with smaller ships there, a gigantic disc, I believe. This is the hallway of the Giza intelligences. And they have gotten these ships underground somehow. I think that what these ships have some ability to change their density, I would say, for lack of a better word or understanding. So these ships are stored underground, and they can probably fly right through the ground back up into the sky without disturbing the ground at all. So there's much about physical science that we still have to learn. These particular people are a splinter group of the Plearian themselves. They are, generally speaking, pretty evil, and they've used religion to manipulate and control the people of Earth for their own ends. One of these Giza intelligences was the Jehovah of the Old Testament of the Bible that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Another one, some of these Giza intelligence people influenced a man who ended up influencing Hitler. And I believe the man's name was Hermann Steinschneider. So these Giza intelligences, sometimes they would take an Earth human who they would somehow totally hypnotize or manipulate, and then use that person to influence others. And this was the one guy, Hermann Steinschneider, who had a big influence on Hitler. So that was a quick summary. Hopefully, in a future show, maybe next show, we'll be able to cover this in detail again. It's a very, very, the study of the Giza intelligences is absolutely fascinating. I think we'll pick up now in contact report. What number is this? 248. And talk a little bit about some things like money and material wealth. So here we go. Billy says, also money and other material wealth of all types lead to the same phenomenon, the lust for power, tyranny, and dictatorship, as well as despotism. But here, there is at least the tendency of a lack of sense of equality, which is created by the people themselves and isn't just given at birth. The expression of the sense of equality, which also includes equal rights, as well as equality for life and legal equality, is the product of properly committed and properly understood evolution through reason, intellect, and awareness. Ah, yes, I still wanted to ask you a few things about the comet that was the actual trigger of the Ark events and that caused the sin flood. The term sin flood also falls with the range of my question, because as a rule, what is meant by this isn't understood by the Earth people. In the past, the Christians remodeled the term for their own use, and especially the Christian churches contributed much to this in that they remodeled the word sin, respectively sint in the word, and maintain the sint flood. Means nothing other than sin flood, loosely based on the assertion that God had punished the disobedient earth people with a colossal and global flood for their sins. But in truth, the term sin flood has nothing to do with the concept of sin, but rather traces back to the very ancient Germanic prefix sin, to which was added the gliding sound of T, by what means the word sint arose. However, sin, respectively sint, in the ancient times, meant something that was very perpetual, collective, or colossal. The term flood is just as ancient and was referred to as vluat at an earlier time. Thus arose the ancient term sint vluat, which then found the value of sintflut in the newer German language. So says the dictionary, that sintflut means colossal flood, great flood, or collective flood, etc. Is that right? Toss says certainly. Billy says good. Then the question about the comet, do you have any records that give information about how large the comet was which triggered the Ark Great Flood about 100,000 years ago? What orbital period this comet has and when it will come again? It would also interest me as to how many such comets or other space projectiles are whizzing around in our solar system, and how many of these can endanger Earth. Well, that might be a good place to stop as well, because otherwise we're going to have to start a long explanation, which then we'll have to cut off arbitrarily somewhere. This information is so fascinating to me. I'm just astonished by it continually. I'm going to finish the show out in the last few minutes here talking about the Might of Thoughts material, but I'm going to try to put it together with some other stuff as well. The Meyer information talks about creational natural laws like love, which they mean brotherly love, or love that's based on integrity, love that's based on the idea of helping others live. And it also has an association with wisdom. Love and wisdom go together. And the creation and its laws are love and wisdom at the same time. Well, this integrity love or brotherly love, the Meyer information calls effective love, goes hand in hand with logic, because love is the highest principle in all creation, and through it, everything exists in absolute logic. So love should be, if it's the right kind of love, logical. Now, if it's very romantic love, then it can be extremely illogical and very painful and hurt the people that are involved in it. So it's very good to have this thing in your mind, this concept that you should be neutral. And I would say that falls within the law of harmony, which is another one of these creational natural laws. So the more neutral you can be, neutral positive, in other words, you're not really overwhelmed with positivity, like a person in love. They're just so positive about the object of their love. And they don't realize that they're putting all this pressure on the object of their love, who is a fallible human being, just like any other. The importance of neutrality allows us to maintain this balance, this equalized balance. That's the law of harmony. That's what the whole book, The Might of Thoughts, in my opinion, much of it is really about that. Trying to stay within that neutral, positive, equalized balance. Now, if you fall into things like unsatisfaction, that will throw off your balance. It also takes away your initiative. If you have suffering in your life, it's most likely because the law of harmony has been broken and disregarded. And if you let unsatisfaction creep into your life, then that will cause you to all of your initiative and your motivation to go away. You know, enthusiasm has the ability to cast a magic spell, literally, and get you motivated again. And a lot of times we destroy our own motivation by wrong thinking. So this law of harmony is very critical. The negative and the positive are two forces that belong together and should never be separated because they depend on one another. And the negative and the positive maintain this balance, this harmony, this equilibrium. The other extremely important law, creational natural law, is the law of striving. And we are told to strive. Striving, the greatest power in every vasen or every being, every entity, is devoted to the striving. If you're a human being or a deer or a cat or a dog, the greatest power in you is really devoted to the striving. Now, I don't understand all the aspects of how all these creatures strive in order to evolve, but they do. Now, we're quite lucky in the sense that we human beings have a higher level of awareness than many other creatures. So we can come to understand, for example, the laws of the universe, where they're programmed into the animals. For example, every tiny plant and every tiny animal fulfills its purpose in love. And love will forever be the purpose of our existence. So love and striving are extremely important for your happiness and, of course, the law of harmony, because if you throw out the law of harmony, then your love becomes more romantic and unstable, and your striving goes to crap. And that's why things like addictions are absolutely devastating, as are anxiety and doubt. It's a necessity to exclude anxiety and doubt, to rigorously exclude anxiety and doubt, for they are evil elements of disintegration. They can take away and wipe out all the hard work and evolution that you've put together. Now, the other really important creational natural law is system and order. System and order says you should put your life together with a schedule and try to adhere to this schedule. Do not allow yourself to fall into aimlessness and purposelessness. You want to keep, and you want to, when you're striving, you're not, as far as I can see in my current level of understanding all this, I don't think you're supposed to like destroy yourself, kill yourself, completely drain yourself. In other words, the striving is this thing that you enjoy, you do, and it gives a lot of purpose to your life, and you have a schedule for your striving. So you're going to do item A at a certain time, item B at a certain time, item C at a certain time. So, and the impulses of striving, I think, go in hand with enthusiasm. And enthusiasm is very, very important in trying to maintain that as much as possible. Anyway, thanks for listening. You've been listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder.